Third Degree today, we focus on rare earths. We take a closer look at the mine site at the heart of the Lynas Corporation's defamation controversy, and we'll hear from a managing director of a company planning to build a rare earths mine in Dubbo. The Third Degree is 2SER's Environment and Social Justice Half Hour. I'm Jessica Mintel, and today we are looking at rare earths. Rare earths are the special metals used in our phones, as well as computers, hybrid cars and wind turbines. China has long been the dominant producer of rare earth, but now Australian rare earth deposits are seeing a flurry of interest. Last week, we looked at the defamation case Lynas Corporation has brought against local community groups in Malaysia, who are campaigning against their planned rare earths refinery in Kuantan. The raw materials for the processing plant are being mined at Lynas's Mount Weld operation in Western Australia. Ore from the mine containing uranium and thorium isotopes is to be transported from the mine site to the port of Fremantle before being taken to Malaysia. And anti-nuclear groups in Western Australia have concerns about what this might mean for those handling the materials along the way. The Third Degree's Simon Unwin spoke to Marcus Atkinson from the Anti-Nuclear Alliance of Western Australia about their referral of this issue to the Environmental Protection Authority in that state.
We have been working with the EDO, the Environmental Defenders Office, and some of the lawyers there for the referral on Lynas and their rare earths operation out at Mount Weld. The reasons we've done that is that the initial approvals were given to Lynas to do that back in 1994. Part of that approvals process included their processing plant, which was to be at MENA. So the original approvals is for them to mine the rare earths at Mount Weld, transport it to MENA, process it and export rare earth metals. Now, over the last 14 years, that plan has changed and now they're doing processing in Malaysia, or they're planning to do the processing in Malaysia, which means that they will be transporting rare earth concentrate from Mount Weld to Fremantle and exporting that. Now, that makes it a completely different project. There's a number of different approvals had to go through the EPA, but it's all been piecemealed together. So we've asked the EPA to reopen that and look at it as an entire new project.
Lynas has actually been saying that the material that they want to transport through Fremantle and out to Malaysia actually falls under safe levels of radioactivity. So if this is the case, you know, what's the problem?
There's a lot of different legalities involved in that. Western Australia has a law that says anything under 10 becquerels per gram can be transported without being labelled as radioactive. The concentrate is 8 becquerels per gram, but that is because of the IAEA's calculation, which gives an exemption to the parent isotope of thorium and uranium. So Australia adopted the IAEA's standards on that, and Malaysia hasn't. So the transportation of the concentrate in Australia is classified at 8 becquerels per gram. Once it hits Malaysia, because of a different calculation, it's calculated at 61 becquerels per gram. So I think this is on paper calculations with exemptions, and it's not the real readings of those materials. So I think there needs to be a stronger look at what the actual radioactive readings of this material is, and there needs to be proper safeguards for people who are handling this material.
So in terms of the upshot of what you're saying there, you know, the Atomic Energy Agency's classifications and measurements and so on, does this mean that we're seeing radioactive material being transported through Australia, through the ports in Fremantle and to Malaysia without being labelled as such, without being labelled radioactive and everything that goes along with that?
Yeah, absolutely, that's correct. And Lynas, for example, is taking advantage of that situation where they're actually doing limited processing at the site at Mount Weld to reduce the amount of concentrate that they have to export, but they're deliberately stopping that process so as it's just under the legal limits where they don't have to label it as radioactive material. Again, I think Australia needs to look at whether these calculations actually help safeguard people's health, or whether we need to re-look at those calculations with exemptions to certain radioactive isotopes.
On what kind of scale are these materials going to be exported? I mean, what's the amount of stuff that we're looking at here passing through Australia's highways and ports?
Yeah, it's a phenomenal amount of concentrate that Lynas wants to move from Mount Weld to Fremantle for export. I think that the figures that we came up with, it would be equivalent to about 40 truckloads a week for 15 years.
And so, I suppose, what are your concerns about the workers, you know, particularly who are handling these materials both at the site, on the road and at the ports? If this stuff isn't labelled correctly and they, I suppose, there's no particular requirement for personal protective equipment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the biggest concerns for us is that the material is not labelled. So will the truck drivers be aware that it is somewhat radioactive? Will the people working at the docks? This material is quite safe when it's contained. It's not emitting enough radiation to be a serious concern. But the problems arise if there is an accident with a truck and this becomes airborne. I think that the gravest concern is that this stuff can be extremely dangerous if it is inhaled or digested in any way. So there needs to be a certain amount of workers' safety and education on if there is a spill, that this is a hazard and it can't just be swept up and thrown in the bin. If you're talking about 40 trucks a week over 15 years, possibilities of a truck accident is very, very high over that period of time. And the possibility of small spills at the docks is also quite high. And if this stuff isn't labelled and if the workers don't have appropriate safety training in this material, it could lead to disastrous effects on the health of these workers.
It's interesting that they were going to put the processing plant in Australia. It makes you sort of wonder about the reasoning that led them to actually relocate their plans for a processing plant to Malaysia.
I think a lot of that is environmental standards and cost saving and a whole range of things, workers' rights and wages. And yeah, there's a whole range of things that has made Lynas move that processing plant to Malaysia.
That was Marcus Atkinson of the Anti-Nuclear Alliance of Western Australia speaking to the Third Degree's Simon Unwin. So we've just been focusing on Lynas Corporation's rare earth operations, but its Mount Weld mine is not the only rare earth hotspot in Australia. Arafura Resources is planning to mine rare earths at Nolans Bore, about 130 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs. And a little closer to home, Alkane Resources is putting together a development application for their Dubbo Zirconia project at Toongai, just outside of Dubbo. This project is still at the application stage. A planning focus meeting was held on site in March with various state departments, Essential Energy, Country Rail and Dubbo Council present, and the company is now doing environmental assessments for their development application. Ian Chalmers is Managing Director of Alkane Resources, the company behind this rare earths project at Dubbo.
It's designed as a million tonne a year ore processing, so basically about a million tonnes a year of rock is mined, and it goes in through the processing plant, which is simplistically, it's a sulfuric acid leach plant, so the sulfuric acid leaches all of the metals of interest out of the rock, and then we have a process, a chemical process, that takes those metals and refines them up to the point where they are sort of in a saleable sense, so the end products are a number of products coming out of site that we can sell elsewhere in the world. That's it simplistically. I mean, the project is very much driven by the zirconium and niobium component of it, so it's not just a rare earth project, it's got zirconium and niobium in it as well. But the rare earths have become far more important in the last 2 or 3 years because of China's dominance of the industry and the rest of the world seeking other sources of supply of rare earths outside of China. So it's really now a three-pronged project, with the metals being, again, as I said, zirconium, niobium and rare earths.
And what are the scale of metals?
Of the metals? Yeah, we'll produce about 50,000 tonnes a year of product, so not very much. It's roughly split, probably about 40% of that volume, or 50% of that volume are zirconium products, probably 20% niobium products, and then the remainder are rare earth products. So there's a whole suite of different things. We basically take them, each of the metal groups, and turn them into products that we can sell. Effectively, you've got to change them into something you can sell. As a rare earth project, it certainly won't be on the, you know, on the world's largest or anything like that. But importantly, it does contain a lot of these, the high-value ones called heavy rare earths. And I can spend hours boring you with the difference here. But the heavy rare earths are the most critical ones today to, you know, the various industries that require them. So we're lucky that our deposit has about 25% of our rare earth content is in these important heavy rare earths.
What do those other metals that you mentioned, what are they mainly used for?
Things like zirconium goes into a whole range of applications, electronic applications. The drying agent in paints now uses zirconium chemical because it's, you know, it's replaced lead, so now that's why your paints are far more environmentally friendly than they used to be. Probably the big use is in the catalytic converter on car exhaust systems. There's a zirconia ceramic. If you've ever looked at your car exhaust, there's a sort of a bulbous thing right at the very back end of the exhaust. That's the catalytic converter that takes the noxious gases coming out of the engine and turns them into something that's sort of far more environmentally friendly. And zirconia ceramic there is a very important component of converting those toxic materials into something that's benign. And that's probably one of the biggest applications of zirconium products today. And as I said, it's a very diverse industry, you know, right through to things like cubic zirconia, which is the, you know, the synthetic diamond jewellery.
So what is the plan for the uranium that will be extracted as part of the process of extracting those other metals and the rare earths?
It doesn't actually get extracted. Basically what happens is that we pull it out of the zirconium circuit because the zirconium, obviously you can't have uranium in it. You'd never be able to move it. You'd never be able to export it. So the uranium gets washed out of that material, but it's in solution. So it never actually gets concentrated as any kind of recognisable uranium product. It's in solution. The solution is acidic. As I said before, it's in a sulfuric acid leach process up front. We then add limestone to neutralise it, and then that process of neutralising it also dilutes the uranium content in it. So what goes out into the tails dam is a neutralised solution, which is less concentration of uranium as it is in the rock on the hill, the current deposit, because you're adding limestone to dilute it. So, yeah, that's where it goes. I mean, we have no plan to recover uranium. We have, you know, even if the government ultimately allowed it to be produced in New South Wales, it's not an economic consideration. It contributes so little to the revenue stream, we wouldn't ever bother about it. So really it just goes out and it's disposed of in the tails dam.
So that uranium that's brought up through the processing will be then stored on site?
Yeah, but it's just the same as it's in less concentration of rock. So you've got the deposit. The deposit contains uranium and thorium, which are your two key radioactive metals. It goes out into the tails dam, but because it's mixed with limestone, it's actually less of a concentration than the rock. So, you know, the rock itself is not radioactive. The tails dam is not radioactive either. So we're not concentrating it. It's not stored. It just goes into a stable deposit in the tailings dam.
You've been working with scientists at ANSTO at Lucas Heights mm-hmm. on a rare earths demonstration pilot plant since 2008.
Yep.
Is this standard practice, or is it, as you were mentioning before, because there's a heavier, it's the heavy rare earths that's found in this deposit?
Really, the reason for going to ANSTO, if you know ANSTO, there are group divisions within it. I mean, there's the nuclear science division, the environment division, those sort of things. But there's also a minerals processing division, and these they're, you know, very, very smart people, very competent people. And we decided that the best place to build our pilot plant was there, because of the access to those people, the access to all the facilities that were available to us at ANSTO, you know, tremendous analytical facilities. And really, it was the flow sheet had been developed before we went there. We'd done that previously at other laboratories, but we needed to build a bigger pilot plant. And that was why it was built at ANSTO, because of all the facilities. So the fact that nothing really to do specifically with the rare earths, it was the fact that we did need to produce zirconium, niobium and rare earth products off that pilot plant so we could check all the chemistry of the flow sheet and also then take those products off to potential customers around the world.
And who are you seeing as being potential buyers of the material and also...
It's actually worldwide. You know, really, there's a big demand for things like rare earths and zirconium in Japan and Korea, also into Europe. Niobium goes in as an additive to steel, and again, it's not a well-known metal, niobium, but it's an interesting one because it goes into special steels, and those special steels right now, say, being used in things like vehicles. You add small amounts of niobium to the steel of a vehicle, and you can drop its weight by 10%, and that gives you fuel efficiencies and emissions minimisations. All these part of these things of, you know, trying to make the world more energy efficient and more conscious of emissions. So our markets are really right across the world. You know, there's no specific end user this stage that we're targeting. We haven't really considered China because China in its own right is a big producer of rare earths and also zirconium products, so there's really not much point going to China to sell those because we just, you know, we're competing with a market that we can't compete in. So that's why the main focus has been Japan and Europe and North America.
And are you looking to sell the raw product or will you...
No, we're taking it as far as we can. I mean, you know, the science of taking these products down to end-use applications is very complex, and there's just none of it done in Australia. But the plan is to, say, take our zirconium products to a higher value as we possibly can. The same with the niobium product. We take it to as high a value as we possibly can. With the two rare earths, it's slightly different. We're basically going to sell a light rare earth concentrate and a heavy rare earth concentrate, or not sell them, rather. We're going to get involved in a joint venture that will take them from the site into somewhere else, and then they'll be processed and separated into their individual components, which are then ready for downstream applications. So, yes, we take them as far as we can technically at this point in time, but you know, maybe sometime in the future we're looking at expanding that, but certainly as far as we can at this stage.
So have you got a place for that refinery plant in mind?
Everything's going to be done on site at Toongi. Everything that we can do, we will do on site at Toongi. So there's no materials being transported off site apart from the end products, and that's that value added product that we can take to. And it's at some stage in the future, if we did decide to do a rare earth separation plant, it would almost certainly be located on site at Toongi. I see no point in taking materials from that site to some other facility. It doesn't make technical sense. It doesn't make economic sense.
Has that allowed you to be a little bit more removed from all of the negative media that Lynas has received over the last few weeks about their plans for a refinery plant in Malaysia?
Yeah, again, they are very different projects. You know, I think that's something that we have to stress. I mean, Lynas's operation is a pure rare earth project. I mean, all they're doing is producing a suite of light rare earths. So they produce a concentrate on site at the mine site, and for their own, you know, their own reasons, have decided to take that to Malaysia for processing. We don't do that because our processing is more built around the zirconium and niobium recovery, and then finally the rare earth recovery. And we don't produce a concentrate up front. We can't do it. Technically, it just doesn't work. So we would never have been able to do what they're doing anyway. So we do everything on site. Everything's contained on site, and just really, it's the final product that leaves the site.
You mentioned earlier that this material is not a high radioactivity. Can I ask how that's being measured?
It's measured both on the ground. I mean, you know, traditionally there are normal techniques measured on the ground, and there is a formula in New South Wales that describes what material, what radioactivity is. So, and you can take the uranium and thorium content, and you can work out what that radioactivity is. So, you know, remember this deposit's been sitting there. It's been farmed for, I don't know, 80 years. I mean, there's wheat and other grains growing around it. There's cattle and sheep graze on it. It's not dangerous in any sense. It's just a pretty typical normal rock of this kind that carries a bit of background uranium thorium. But I mean, it's accurately measured. We know exactly how much uranium thorium's in the rock. We know exactly what the emissions are. We know, obviously, you know, we're very mindful of that issue when we look at the processing plant and what goes on in the processing plant, and then ultimately what's in the tailings. And as I said before, it really, you know, we're taking a rock that's been sitting up on the side of the hill and farmed for 80 years, and we're actually dropping its content of radioactive materials by the time it gets into the tails dam. So it's, you know, it doesn't create an issue anyway.
And that was Ian Chalmers, Managing Director of Alkane Resources, the company planning a rare earths mine at Toongi, just outside of Dubbo. Lee Bell is a senior researcher with the National Toxics Network. He has a keen interest in the Lynas Rare Earths project and has also kept an eye on the publicly available information for this Alkane Resources mine in Dubbo. I asked Lee Bell to speak on a couple of points raised just now by Ian Chalmers. First up, what does he think of comments about the process outlined to neutralise and dilute the uranium content in the waste tailings? Here's Lee Bell.
When you remove the uranium and the thorium from the ore body during the refining process, you're effectively concentrating that uranium and thorium and putting that into a concentrated form into your waste disposal ponds. Yes, there will be limestone added because that's required to neutralise the sulfuric acid during the stripping process that they use. But if you look at, say, the Lynas production facility, which has a lot more detailed information available on it, the Malaysian plant, the Lynas Advanced Materials plant, they use virtually exactly the same process, although there may be some small technical variations on it. And what you find in that case is the uranium and thorium levels are actually the same as the ore body that it's initially derived from up in Mount Weld. It doesn't change a great deal. In a sense, what you're saying is that whatever uranium and thorium goes into the beginning of the refinery process, the same amount of uranium and thorium comes out. They're suggesting that the limestone will somehow dilute it. But as anyone in the environment knows, dilution is not the solution to pollution. Industry likes to think it is, but the reality is you're going to have a concentrated, if you like, waste dump containing uranium and thorium. The use of words such as dilution and stabilisation are fairly loose terms that are being used in relation to this Dubbo project. In one sentence, the producers may say that, but in another sentence, they suggest that both the uranium and the thorium that they remove from the initial ore body may be of high enough quality to be developed and sold on the market as uranium and thorium. The radioactivity doesn't change. So I think that there's, if you like, a bit of a use of some cute semantics going on in the language around this.
But that's in contrast with what we just heard Ian Chalmers saying about how they will not be seeking a market for the uranium or thorium product.
They quote in one of the documents that they have made publicly available that uranium is removed from the zirconium stream, but the barrier, I guess, to making that marketable is it depends on state approvals, because there are limitations on what you can do with uranium in New South Wales and restrictions on its refining. So they're suggesting that it could be recovered to what they call a saleable product, and they also suggest that thorium, which is also radioactive, could be removed from their niobium product, which is another rare earth that they're developing, and that that could also be marketed. So currently they're only talking about basically putting the uranium and thorium into the waste disposal facility, but that they're currently also looking at whether they can market those two products, which would require more refining or a change to their current refining operation. So they're certainly considering that if they can get political approval for it, and obviously that would be a significant barrier.
I also asked about the levels of radioactivity that would be present, as Ian Chalmers said this was not a high radioactivity level.
It's a complex issue, but it depends on what you're comparing it to. No, it's nothing like the high-level radioactive waste you might receive from a reactor, but certainly it has levels of radioactivity within the waste that must be regulated, and in some cases, certainly for the workers at the plant, there would have to be radioactive monitoring and protective equipment supplied, because the levels that are contained, particularly within the zirconia plant, of uranium and thorium are of a sufficient level to, if you like, trigger occupational health and safety levels. That would have to be carefully monitored, because the ore body isn't, if if you like, homogeneous. There will be hot spots of these elements within the ore body, and as that's removed from the ground, there will be higher and lower levels of radioactivity at different times, and that has to be carefully monitored to ensure that the workers aren't exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. The waste itself appears to be a lot higher in radioactivity than what you would be seeing at the Lynas plant in Malaysia, which has regulators concerned to some degree over there. So here we're talking about uranium levels of perhaps 140 parts per million compared to the waste in Lynas' product of about 30 parts per million. So I don't think it's accurate to say that they don't pose any long-term issues or that the radioactivity is so low that it's not of concern.
That's Lee Bell from the National Toxics Network speaking about the planned rare earths mine at Dubbo. Alkane Resources are planning to have their environmental impact statement lodged before the end of the year, and then, depending on the approval process, are hoping to begin construction at the end of next year and to start production in 2015. And so from rare earths, we now move to coal mining. The expansion of coal mining into farmland and native forest in northwestern New South Wales shows no sign of slowing down. The state government's planning bodies have recently given the go-ahead for several new open-cut coal mines in the Gunnedah Basin. Three of these mines are located in and around the Laird State Forest near Boggabri, where there's currently thousands of hectares of native woodland. Last month, Carmel Flint from the Northern Inland Council for the Environment locked herself onto a bulldozer to protest the clearing of part of the state forest to make room for the mines. Third Degree's Simon Unwin grew up just over the Capitar Ranges from the forest, and he spoke to Carmel Flint.
I did that because what's happening in Laird State Forest is there are three massive open-cut coal mines that are either started or proposed for expansion or new mines in the area. It's in a state forest which belonged to the Republic of New South Wales, which is the largest remnant of bushland left on the Liverpool Plain. It includes large areas of critically endangered fox gum woodland. And we were protesting, and I in particular locked on for the bulldozer to protest against the destruction of the forest for open-cut coal mining.
I imagine that there have been other avenues through which to protest against the possibility of these mines going ahead. What's been happening in that respect?
Yeah, well, it has been a long process. We sought to have the area protected in national parks as part of the Brigalow Belt decision in 2005. Community groups, including ours, the local farming association groups, have put in sort of big and detailed submissions to the government in relation to the environmental assessments that were proposed. But that has all gone nowhere, basically. The Maules Creek Community Council, who live next door to these mines, have really set a new standard in community submissions to the environmental assessments. They've done incredible work collecting the best scientific evidence, getting experts to critique the assessments, but that has all fallen on deaf ears. We've done detailed submissions, and it's really got us nowhere.
It seems strange that a coal mine should be able to bulldoze vast parts of a state forest, where if a farmer wanted to do the same thing, you know, that there would be a whole raft of things to stop them doing that.
Exactly. This is a real double standard going on here. The extractive industries, particularly mining, have got to be run. The endangered ecosystems that occur in this forest, they're not allowed to clear. Farmers basically get a red light. They're not allowed to clear this type of ecosystem under any circumstances. But the mining industries would have a free run.
And it's a really very lovely part of the world. It's very sad that it's being threatened in such a way. Look, what's next for the campaign in and around Maules Creek?
We're pursuing all remaining avenues to prevent these mines going ahead. You know, we will pursue, we'll look into legal avenues. We're still doing advocacy and trying to get various governments to see the ridiculous, you know, extreme nature of this proposal and to knock these mines back. We're going to put some effort into the Federal Environment Minister, Tony Burke. He can knock these mines back because they have been called in under the federal environment laws. And you know, what he will have to sign off on if he does is the clear felling of a critically endangered ecosystem that's nationally listed. Probably one of the best and most intact stands of box gum woodland left in eastern Australia. There's 100 hollows per hectare in the white box forest in Laird, which means it's just incredibly good habitat for hollow-dependent fauna. And there's very few stands of box gum left in that condition. So I think it's a huge test for Tony Burke to convert a forest into a huge dust bowl, basically, that will then dump about 18,000 tonnes of dust on adjoining farmland. In this day and age, that sort of mine shouldn't be going ahead. It's like a third world mine complex in a first world country. And Tony Burke, sooner or later, has to start knocking a few mines back if the Environment Protection Act is to have any credibility whatsoever. And we think these mines are going to be a huge test for him.
For the New South Wales government, they really have to consider whether they do want a huge tract of New South Wales, more or less from Gunnedah and Boggabri, right, all the way down to Newcastle, whether they do want that just as mining country or food-producing farmland.
At the moment, it's just going full tilt ahead to turn the Gunnedah Basin into the next Hunter Valley. We're just doing it all over again.
What the mining companies and the New South Wales government would be saying at this point is that this is, you know, going to bring a lot of money and jobs into these communities. I mean, what would you say to that?
Yeah, well, basically these mines are looking at just a massive fly-in, fly-out workforce. So they're not delivering many jobs for local workers. There's a very strong agriculture and tourism industries which are really going really well, and the biggest threat to them is the mining, the agriculture and tourism really struggling to pay the same kind of money for jobs and ending up not being able to employ anyone. So there's this massive impact on our strongest and most sustainable industries, such as agriculture and tourism, from what is a short-term extractive industry that is also going to do a lot of environmental damage.
That was Carmel Flint of the Northern Inland Council for the Environment speaking to Simon Unwin. Carmel was also on the move yesterday, so please forgive the quality of the sound there. I'm Jessica Mitchell. This is The Third Degree, and you're on 2SCR. Stay tuned for The Daily and Steph. ¶¶